I think we'll all agree Alcola is a wonderful addition to Dalston, and we're extremely relieved that although they're leaving their present building, they're finding a new home locally, and I hope that they will stay and they will build their new carbon-free theatre in Dalston as well. And I'd like to thank them all for the lighting that they've put on here tonight, which was a huge effort, particularly David Salter, who organised the lighting. Now we have Ian Sinclair, I think, is here to read for us, and Ella was going to set up a shot for him to read against or over or under or whatever. So I'd like to welcome Ian. We're fortunate to have him. He's one of the few premises in Hackney where he's actually allowed to read. And so over to you, Ian.
This is a very extraordinary space in lots of ways. It seems to be one thing, and then when it looked like it's a bit harder, it's something else. In the same way that I saw a very snaky kind of jazz man over there with his horn, and I thought it was a solicitor called Bill Parry Davis. And then I saw some sturdy bikers, and they turned out to be vicars. So for the purposes of this evening, I'll pretend to be a writer. And everything about this building struck me as magnificent. The scale, the mystery, except maybe the acoustics were a little weird. I don't know if you can hear me okay, but I'll try and do it. I thought in honor of where we are and what we're doing, I'd try and be like Hackney Council. And in the same way, I thought I would pay my respects in the sense that I know as much about what I'm going to talk about as they know about civic architecture and planning, which is nothing. And I'm going to follow the theme of the evening by reading a bit from a new book about money. The book is called Ghost Milk, Calling Time on the Grand Project. And if my previous book, Hackney, got me banned from libraries without even trying, I don't know what this one's going to do. We'll see. I've had to work much harder to get banned this time. The great metaphor that seems to have gone wrong at the moment in everything around us and all of the things that Open Dalston has touched on come from this strange substance. And the metaphor seems to have gone seriously wrong, as I discovered. The actual chapter is called, which I'll cut down for you, it's called Funny Money. And it starts with a little quote from Thomas Pynchon. "It isn't money exactly," Sancho suggested. "It's more like new debt." Suddenly, I was rich. At a time when banks were collapsing and bankers topping themselves or selling their apologias before doing some rehab in an open prison, loot was rolling in. The technology made it so easy. Every morning as the screen cleared its sticky-eyed scrot, a good news assault provided my wake-up call. The Spanish were blush-makingly generous, emphasizing my turn of fortune in block capitals and promiscuous underlinings. The Loteria Primitiva in Madrid was not so primitive after all. They couldn't hardly contain their pleasure in letting me be the first to know that my ticket number 015-11464860 had come home. You have therefore been approved for a lump payment of €985,950 only. I loved that only. And I loved the pleasure they took in my good luck. Congratulations. And the most astonishing aspect was that I didn't even have to buy a ticket. I had never bought a Spanish lottery ticket or any other kind. Nothing in my prejudiced view was more depressing than witnessing the urban poor queuing to shell out their shares for shares in the Millennium Dome and all the other New Labour vanity projects. There are more scratchers addicted to loss in the mini-marts of Dalston than in the flea-pit cinemas of 1960s Dublin. All that was asked was that I keep my award away from public notice and I pay 10% of my winnings to an agent. Nothing new there. An attached form made it a very simple matter to pass on the relevant banking details. Before I could trouser that first rattle of Spanish doubloons and plot my retirement to the coast to watch the horizon and do a little painting, there was another download from the Iberian largesse, and this time the El Gordo sweepstake had drawn a ticket which once again I had not been obliged to purchase. Here was a new form of gambling, every one a winner. Away after the urban renewal of the Barcelona Olympics to foster a climate of European goodwill by offering funds to difficult authors and disguising cultural awards as lottery triumphs. Over in Madrid, a favorite city of mine, last seen at the age of 20, they recognized quality when they saw it. How very discreet of them to avoid vulgar prize-giving ceremonies, for which, in any case, I'd permanently disqualified myself by blundering into a form of writing that was neither fiction nor non-fiction. This time, it was 615,810 euros, and it was mounting up nicely. The conditions were the same, keep it buttoned, 10% to our agent. I would soon have enough to buy a flat in one of those lovely new towers overlooking the site of Westfield Shopping Mall. Contracts were on the point of exchange when Loteria Primitiva came back to top up the pot, with only 3 exclamation marks this time after the congratulations, and with another tidy lump, 815,810 pounds only. Maybe they'd mistaken my failure to activate my claim for a prejudice against euros. And this was far from the end of my winning streak. I began to think I was personally responsible for the credit crunch by mopping up all of those global slush funds, the shiny trinkets hidden in the hedges. I was operating at a Bishopsgate bonus level. I should be out there propping up the economy of Shoreditch by sniffing and snorting and guzzling and shoving wads of readies into the vestigial underwear of lap dancers. But the really creepy stuff started to kick in when total strangers started paying checks into my apparently secure account. £4,500, £4,300, £9,500, £4,900, and £905,000 again. By the close of pay on the 5th of January 2009, I was £32,700 to the good. A gesture, perhaps, from a well-wisher in response to the difficulties surrounding the launch of my new book, Hackney, That Rose-Red Empire. The bulk of my readership, so I understand it, consists of Hackney-born sentimentalists exiled to the north and far west. The pretty cover qualified this as a suitable present to be given by new London fielders so that the old folk out there can write to me and just let me know just where I got it wrong. The telephone, interrupting my reverie, broke the spell. The HSBC Bank Security Division wanted to know why I'd had a rush of blood that had me spraying checks out to a gentleman whose name rang no bells. My security code meant nothing. I don't use internet banking, and there was no protection. I was hemorrhaging money I didn't have. The large checks could be blocked, but they started modestly with 50 and then a few hundred and a few hundred again. And those sums had gone, and they would have to be reclaimed later. In one day, they cleared £37,000, which was never there and which left me staring at a black hole as fantastic as the promises of the Spanish lottery. My account was being used as a clearinghouse for intricate drug-connected deals, and when I arrived at the bank and found an actual person to talk to in one of those comfortable little partitioned areas, she was very relaxed about the whole affair. It was, she admitted, very commonplace. It happens all the time, and especially in the early part of the year after Christmas. There's no such thing as money anymore, she said. Not as we once knew it. That metaphor has collapsed. It's as anachronistic as a DeLorean car. Money has moved away from an Adam Smith or a Maynard Keynes scientific rigor to a dopey sort of psychedelic soap bubble. We should think of those Wall Street jackals and the Lee Valley visionaries as the poets of a new unreality, where anything is everything. I interviewed a media-savvy architect in his Riverside studio. He doodled as he spoke, towers and floating rings like a manifestation of the hoops of smoke he puffed as he wailed a French cigarette in three drags. I recorded his riff. The Olympic Park will be a disaster. The press are so mealy-mouthed. Everybody knows when it's all done, we're going to have a bill of at least £20 billion. The starting figure means nothing at all. The civil servants are right behind it. They announce budgets that are acceptable to the politicians, budgets that receive full political backing, and they have no bearing on the truth whatsoever. They say, we can always blame it on the architects, which is what they always do. The world of grand project accounting is completely unreal. The figures are just floated, and if you tell the truth, you won't get the job. Sadly, the public sector is the worst. The closer you get to the Stratford construction site, the more money, as civilians understand it, loses its meaning. I think that what they're actually building in those tunnels and bunkers, deep inside the dangerous, unexploded ordnance-infested clay, is a gigantic particle accelerator, like the facility at CERN in Switzerland. Why else would they need to curtain this landscape in blue plywood to employ regiments of Gurkhas? My Lee Valley string theory, attempting to reconcile quantum mechanics and relativity, blunders into previously unsuspected dimensions, which include multiverses of insecure investment, global terror websites, and a wilderness of counterfactual theology. Cutting-edge physics cohabits with Mayan 2012 endgame prophecies to deliver a new economics. The more you owe, the richer you are. Well, we understand that perfectly well. But the more you owe, the more you fuck up, the more you will be given. They call that anomaly cancellation. In other words, if a flaw can be described, wipe it out and sue the shit out of anybody who complains about radioactive dust drifting over their pristine estate. And if the worst comes to the worst, establish a committee to elect another committee to draw up a report to be evaluated by government-appointed experts. Government-appointed experts before being turned into an incoming administration because it's nothing to do with them. Improving the image of construction. I was uneasy about a few £1,000 coming and going from my bank account. The grand project managers were made of sterner stuff. The HSBC associate who dealt with the fraud I had experienced as casually or more casually than an overdraft exceeded by a fiver explained that the Olympics had set off a deluge of cybercrime. A notion supported in an article by Mark Prigg in The Standard. Prigg alluded to a plethora of websites punting premature souvenirs and tickets for seats that would never arrive. You could buy, if you were sufficiently deluded, a virtual Olympic torch. Graham Cluley at the online security firm Sophos is reported as saying, the 2012 Games is going to attract a lot of criminal attention. There's going to be an explosion in junk mail and scams. So things are not as bad as they might be, because given the regularity of the postal strikes and the mountainous backlog to be cleared, the junk mail won't get through. And the scams will not come close to the sanctioned disappearances and the escalating budgets of the Olympic Park developers. The LDA, with a generous allowance to buy up land from those about to be evicted from the Lower Lee Valley, managed to mislay £159 million. The managers responsible for closing down the allotments will now take an extended gardening leave. Forensic accountants expected an overspend of £32 million, but discovered that the figure had crept up by almost five times that amount. There has been no evidence of fraud, just mismanagement. Another cancelled anomaly, they said, to be made good when the land is flogged off after the games. Thank you. I should say that during this process of looking at the games, I discovered another metaphor has also collapsed, which was a kind of lazy way of talking about certain kind of developments when they looked really bad, housing developments. Oh, that looks like East Berlin. Well, in the course of researching the whole Olympic process, I went to Berlin and I had a good look at the houses and the flats and the buildings in East Berlin, and they're pretty good. They're not too bad at all, and they've been recovered, and they look a lot healthier than most of what's going on around here. And I also discovered that the entire project, the kind of new Labour project, was basically road tested by the new socialists in Berlin in 1936. The whole idea that everything depends upon spin, that you get the PR right and everything else follows. The Berlin Olympics of 1936 also were the first to do things like reinvent the carrying of the Olympic torch. So essentially, as someone said, that you know, you take out the bad things and they're not so bad. We can learn a lot from them. And I think this is basically where the project started. And in the course of the book, I finish up there. And then after that, in Athens, where you see stunning projects, amazing parks, better pieces of architecture than we've got, completely abandoned, full of feral dogs, overgrown, broken, empty flats. Stunning in a kind of sense, like a J.G. Ballard theme park, but also a wonderful symbol for the bankruptcy of a country. So that's just a few thoughts on money. Thank you. Sorry, I couldn't.
Austerity Games,
right? Yeah, very good. Yeah. No, I mean, I think the Austerity Games, 1948, as far as I can tell, I wasn't very old at that time, were a great model of how you do something with minimal means, but with a lot of spirit, just incorporating structures that were already there. People, the athletes staying in old RAF huts and people's houses, and it meant something. It wasn't a sort of entirely a global corporate entity at all at that time. In the same way that the Festival of Britain in 1951 incorporated a lot of wonderful elements in terms of London, and had this moment when there was an old terrace of houses on the edge of the site that was going to be demolished as part of the site for the Festival of Britain on the South Bank, and the people who were living in it said, look, we don't mind becoming part of the show. You can keep the house, and we will sort of stand as a representation of a sort of British way of life at a particular period. And they thought, ah, okay. and they built that into the games. Well, exactly the same pitch was made with the Manor Garden allotments, where they said, look, you know, we're doing everything that these games are going to bring as a legacy. We're completely multicultural. We're bringing all kinds of disparate people together. We're reclaiming the soil. We're doing everything that's going to be done. Can't we be incorporated into the structure of the game? He said, no, no way. And the person who said that, a man called Gareth Blacker, is the person who's taking gardening leave after this mysteriously vanishing quantity of £1 million. There's no way of thinking in that sense. And he said the reason for this is that this is going to be the most secure event that this country has ever seen. Whereas you create the situation for the threat, and then you make that the excuse for doing everything else. So I think it is quite enlightening to look back at things like the 1948 Games and the 51 Festival of Britain as against what happened with the Millennium Dome. We've got carried away by the kind of mystique of puffing these projects and by the destruction of language, so that if you're ruining something, you call it improving the image of construction. You don't build. You throw out a phrase like direction of travel to say that it's not going to happen now, but you're moving in the right direction. We saw earlier the images of the Eton Manor and the Mission, these kind of slightly patronizing but generous events that happened through public school figures in the late 19th century. And looking into that, I discovered that everything that is now coming was actually here at that period. That a whole series of football pitches and the Manor Garden allotments, boating clubs on the River Lee, all of those things were actually put in place by people raising their own funds and doing it because they wanted to do it and providing these facilities. And secondly, a publican, there's a good piece on this in one of the Hackney Archive magazines, Hackney Society, had a running track put into the back of his own pub out in Hackney Wick, very close to the Olympic site, using the railway embankments as a stand for the people to come to, and staged a kind of miniature Olympic Games at his own expense, bringing over Native American runners, people from all over the world, to take on the English champions. Hugely popular, just happened in the back of his pub, went away and extended into Victoria Park, happened there, finished. No kind of epic tearing and ripping of London to do it. It's possible, and it's been there, and actually all of the elements that were there have gradually been lost. Everything I write is true. No, that part of it is absolutely true. Yeah, no, huge amounts were flooding in and then mysteriously flooded out without really ever having been there, which is the nature of money. And I don't know what would happen if I kind of hadn't been around at this time and this whole process had just rippled on. I might now be very, very rich or very, very poor. But the idea is that you can kind of be persuaded by these floating technologies to believe anything without anything having actually happened. I think the moment when this business changed for me was in the early 1970s, when I worked on what is now the Westfield site in Stratford. I was working in a place called Chobham Farm, which was container loading and disloading shed on the old railways, and they used to pay us every week in cash. So you got your brown envelope and you opened it up. There was this thing called money, and everybody took it away and they did everything they did in the week, and by the next week it was all gone and they got some more money. And then at a certain point the operator said, this is not going to happen anymore, I'm sorry, it all has to go through a bank. And they said, but we haven't got checkbooks. We're not in that system. We like to. He said, I'm sorry, it can't be done anymore. It's security. So you had to walk down to the high street in Stratford, and they were all issued with checkbooks, and You know, here was the money. But this time it passed through somebody else's hands. It goes into another system. And that is the kind of point when the whole world changed. If they only knew it, they were actually prophesying the Olympic Games at that moment of time. They were handing themselves into the sponsorship of Coca-Cola and McDonald's and everybody else. What I hadn't appreciated till I saw an event at on mapping at the British Library on Saturday, and there was a very convincing presentation that showed how deeply in hoc all the British cultural institutions are on one level to BP oil, essentially the Tate, you know, all of those grand and glittering structures were funded and patronized by oil companies. Something like 9% of the gross national product was coming from here. And the interweavings were so intricate, it was quite staggering to me that the head guy was also head of BP and all of this stuff. And you realize, you know, we're using very ecologically sound lighting here tonight, but generally speaking, the metaphors are getting pretty weird all around us.
I think that's the sign to finish.